Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Push Podcast.
Hi, everybody.
I'm Sydney. I'm a labor and delivery nurse and an online educator, content creator in the birthing postpartum world.
And I'm Megan. I'm an OBGYN, a clinical researcher, and a new mom myself. So yes. Navigating a lot of the postpartum experiences for the first time in real practice.
Yeah, which has been such a good conversation starter with a lot of our topics on the Push Podcast. So today we are talking about a very special episode for Polycystic Ovarian Syndrome Awareness Month, which is September. Mm-hmm. So we are going to dive in and talk about PCOS.
Perfect. Yeah. We're trying to keep up on all of the different highlight months throughout the year.
Yeah.
If we miss one that's particularly relevant to you guys and to our audience in general, please know we will circle back to these topics.
Of course.
I'm realizing there's a lot of highlight months through
there
the year.
Which is
great. So many of these conditions need to be talked about and we need to kind of enhance awareness of what these things are.
Absolutely.
But your girls are struggling to keep up a little
bit. I know. There's a lot. But we felt like PCOS was like a good topic to talk about.
Particularly
for sure.
Relevant right now, right?
Yeah.
I think a lot of people are talking about hormone health in general online.
Yes.
And PCOS being a predominantly hormonally driven disorder is something that invariably comes up, I think.
Yeah, for sure. Well, before we get into it, I have to say you're looking great in your scrubs.
Thank you, Nurse Sydney. So are you in
your
custom monogrammed scrubs.
Yes. So thank you, Garde Malade. They sent us these beautiful embroidered scrubs. We love them. If you guys haven't checked out Garde Malade before, they are a Canadian, Montreal-based, women-owned business, or women-founded business, I should say. And I've been wearing their scrubs for years, and they're super comfy, super stretchy, breathable. And they come in the cutest colors.
They really do.
I love. Yeah.
I have to say, too, I've told you this a few times, I think, actually offline, but I've tried out scrubs from lots of different companies before, and I have to say these are very lightweight.
Right?
They're very lightweight. Yeah. They're very stretchy.
Yeah.
I don't feel encumbered. I don't feel sweaty in them.
Yes.
Which is really, really great.
Which is needed in scrubs.
Yeah.
1,000%.
I'm running around clinics so fast half the time that I can't be held back by my scrubs.
No,
so
absolutely not.
God, my lad, thank you so much. We are a little bit biased being that both of us have roots in Montreal.
Yes.
And we are, and we have got lots of family there and we are super keen to support Canadian businesses in general. But we really objectively
truly
like
love
these
them.
Scrubs.
Yes.
We wouldn't be talking about it
exactly.
if we didn't.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So thank you again.
Thank you so much.
Go check them out if you haven't already. Mm-hmm. And also, you guys might notice we're in a little bit of a different environment.
Yeah.
This new pink walls. I love it. I love it. This was Dr. Megan's new office vision, I should say. Dream office space.
Well, I think as we've alluded to before, we moved recently. So that's part of why August was so bananas right here at the Push Podcast because we had, between Sydney and I, a lot going on in our personal lives.
Oh, yeah.
But what the move allowed us to do, too, is kind of reimagine an office space.
Yes.
With, honestly, some of our Push Podcast branding in mind.
Oh, yeah.
So,
oh, yeah.
But aside from that, too, I think in this chapter of my career, I've really been feeling heartened to like recapture some of my own femininity in a professional sense, in a professional context.
Yeah.
I think a lot in, I'm sure a lot of people would say this in a variety of different careers, especially those that have been, traditionally more male dominated, like surgery.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of a pressure to dampen some of that down, especially when you're in training. And now that I'm a staff, I'm kind of celebrating those feminine aspects a little bit more.
Your pink back.
Listen, if you can't have a pink office as an adult, when can you?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's the best part of growing up. You
I
paint your office
that.
Whatever damn color you want.
Oh, yeah. And it's so cute. And we're going to get like a nice little couch for in here so we can be cozy.
So pin in this for now. This our set is going to change over the next little while.
Yeah, but I'm so excited. But it's a lovely, lovely new space. So we hope you guys like it too on YouTube. You can see it. And
exactly. Let us know how we should decorate because we're really just getting into it. But without further ado, all home decor aside, yes, let's get into PCOS for PCOS Awareness Month.
Yeah, yeah. So let's go over actually, let me give you like a little rundown mm-hmm. of what we're actually going to be talking about today, mm-hmm. just so that, you know, if you don't have much time and you want to stick around yeah. or save this for later, you'll actually know what we're going to talk about. So we're going to give an actual rundown of what is PCOS, mm-hmm. How common it is, and why it happens. And then we're also going to talk about like signs and symptoms, health implications of this diagnosis, how diagnosis happens, how you actually mm-hmm. get diagnosed. And then we're going to go over management, treatment options, and then also debunking some myths, misconceptions, and social media trends that you might see yeah. online, because PCOS gets a lot of online attention, I feel
I think so too. And yeah. rightly so, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, we'll get into why that is and how common it is of a mm-hmm. diagnosis. And maybe that's why. And then just some tips on living with PCOS. Mm-hmm. So make sure you stick around, listen to the whole episode. And I hope it helps some of you guys out there who may have been diagnosed with PCOS or think that this is a condition that you might have.
Yeah, or suspect you have it, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Alrighty. Well, listen, let's get into it. I think before we talk about any of the fun details, fun for somebody who's a little bit of like a science nerd like me, I don't suggest yeah. that it's fun to be living with
PCOS. To be living with it, yeah.
Especially if it's untreated and undiagnosed and not taken seriously, oh, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But generally speaking, at the baseline, PCOS is a hormonal disorder that affects ovarian function. So basically, it's one of the most common endocrine disorders or hormonal system disorders, mm-hmm. Particularly that affects people with ovaries of reproductive age. Mm-hmm. And in order, I think, to understand why PCOS does the things it does, right? Mm-hmm. And why it causes this like hormonal imbalance, as is the like oft, you know, referenced term, yeah. especially in social media, I think we have to rewind a little bit to understand again a bit more about the menstrual cycle in general.
Yeah.
Now, if you have not listened to our episode, This Is Your Body on the Pill, please go back and listen to at least our menstrual cycle yes. briefer in that
it's
episode.
It's such a good episode, you guys.
It's one of my favorite episodes. It's so good.
Like, and I feel like, you know, as a woman with mm-hmm. with the reproductive mm-hmm. organs, oh my God, why couldn't I think of the word uterus? I'm sorry, I'm still warming up, you guys. Apparently, I need to wake up. But as a woman with a uterus, I think like every woman needs to know what their body
how
does.
Our body works.
And how it works. Right? Yeah. Totally, totally. Yeah.
So go back to that episode. Just listen to the menstrual yeah. cycle part if you want.
Yeah.
To kind of give you a quick sense of what we're talking about. But I yeah. will try to like contextualize as much of this as possible.
Yeah, yeah.
So basically, part of how our menstrual cycle works is that our brain has to tell our ovaries, which then tell our uterus to produce different hormones and get different parts ready so that an egg can be released and yeah. ultimately a baby could be conceived,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And again, that starts kind of at the brain level. So the brain talks to the ovaries using two predominant hormones, FSH or follicle stimulating hormone and LH or luteinizing hormone. And this is a like broad simplification.
Yeah.
But basically, FSH helps to grow an egg each month, and LH helps to trigger the release of that egg. And that is ovulation, right? It's the release of an egg. Mm-hmm. At the same time, those ovaries are also producing estrogen and a little bit of androgens, or what we would think of as like male hormones, like mm-hmm. testosterone. Now, in PCOS, the balance of these signals gets a little bit mixed up for some reasons that we understand and some reasons that we're still continuing to elucidate a little bit better. Mm-hmm. But basically, in PCOS, the brain produces too much LH compared to FSH.
Okay.
Right? And also the pattern that the brain is sending out LH is a little bit discoordinated.
Okay.
And what that means practically is that we get tons of little tiny follicles starting to grow. But none really get the full push to mature to become a dominant follicle and a right. mature egg that would then get released with ovulation. Right. So because the eggs don't mature properly, ovulation doesn't occur and periods mm. can become very irregular or stop entirely.
Okay.
Now, again, luteinizing hormone, it doesn't just cause release of the egg.
Yeah.
It also acts on a different set of cells within the ovary called theca cells and stimulates them to produce androgens, right? Again, those male pattern hormones like testosterone. And in a normal menstrual cycle, we want those because they are part of the same kind of biochemical pathway as things like estrogen, right?
Yeah.
And so that testosterone is usually converted into estrogen by the follicles under the influence of FSH. Mm. So if you're following me, we kind of have this like this one pattern that starts to become a little bit discoordinated, and it has all of these downstream effects, right?
Yeah.
That impact the way the hormones are circulating in our bodies. So again, in summary, in PCOS, the brain makes more LH than FSH. Tons of tiny follicles start to develop but never get the signal to ovulate. Mm. And the theca cells get overstimulated by LH, which means they're pumping out more androgens. And there isn't enough FSH present to fully mature the follicles, so we get less conversion of the androgens into estrogen. Mm. What this second part of PCOS results in is androgen buildup, right? And that's what causes symptoms like acne, hair growth on the face or body, and scalp hair thinning, to name a few.
Okay.
Okay. So that's kind of the background of this picture of constellations of symptoms that are symptoms that we'll talk about in a little bit more detail later.
Yeah.
Now, there's kind of a secondary thing going on with PCOS as well. For reasons, again, that some of them we are starting to understand, some of them we're continuing to elucidate a little bit better. Many people with PCOS also have cells that don't respond quite as well as we would like or expect to insulin. Mm. Now, insulin, I'm sure people are familiar with as a major chemical that is important in the context of diabetes, right? Yeah. Or processing sugar.
Yeah.
So basically, insulin allows our body to take in circulating sugar in our bloodstream from the meals that we eat and to store it into cells to be used for energy later on. Mm-hmm. And what that means when people are a bit insulin resistant, right? Mm-hmm. Or they don't respond well to insulin, is that the body has to make more and more insulin in order to get the same effect, right? That is essentially what insulin resistance means. High insulin levels can, number one, tell the ovaries to produce even more androgens like testosterone, which exacerbates some of those symptoms that we are experiencing.
Yeah.
It also can make it easier to gain weight over time and harder to lose it.
Yeah.
And again, over time can raise the risk of type 2 diabetes. Mm-hmm. So PCOS and insulin resistance are inextricably linked in many ways, right? And we'll talk about some of the reasons why that may be later. But again, the extra androgens in PCOS make insulin work less effectively. And then the higher insulin in turn drives up androgen production, which creates this like vicious cycle of exacerbation of symptoms. So again, I think it's important to start to talk about some of these things in a little bit more detail, right? And in a way that is easily understandable, because it's not enough for us to just say, oh, hormonal imbalance, right?
Yeah.
Because it isn't always even like the levels of the hormones, right? Yeah. Sometimes it's a bigger problem about the way that those hormones are interacting with each other and the way that they're interacting with different parts of our bodies, right?
Yeah.
Now, for diagnosis of PCOS, we use what's called the Rotterdam criteria. And to be diagnosed, you only need two out of three of the following. So the first would be irregular or absent ovulation. Mm. Again, we got those follicles that are developing into tiny little premature follicles in response to some FSH, but never get quite enough to develop into a mature follicle that would then release an egg, leading to anovulation or lack of ovulation. And oftentimes, subsequently, we don't get the signal to have a period.
Right.
The second one would be elevated androgens. Mm-hmm. And that can be in either the form of symptoms, right? So again, significant acne, hair growth in places that it wouldn't typically grow for women. And it also can be present in the form of abnormal lab results, right? So we can test for testosterone and to see whether or not that is in fact elevated beyond the levels that we would expect. Now, the last thing is polycystic ovaries on ultrasound. Mm-hmm. I think it's a little bit of a misnomer to call them polycystic ovaries. Even the whole naming of it is a little bit of a misnomer because they're not true ovarian cysts, right?
Yeah.
Or like the water balloons that can develop within the ovary that have a whole other etiology and a whole other kind of diagnostic criteria to figure out like what the underlying cause is and whether we should be concerned or
like
not.
Like it should have been called something with hormonal imbalance,
polyfollicular, like ovary. I don't know. And you know what? Again, like the cysts on the ovary are a symptom of the underlying issue, right? As opposed to like the major feature themselves.
Yeah.
But in any case, polycystic, when we say polycystic ovaries on ultrasound, what we mean again is not big cysts, but lots of small immature follicles that we see. Mm. And sometimes what this is called on the ultrasound reports is a string of pearls appearance. So you can see kind of like this little string of tiny little circles all around the ovary when we look at it under the ultrasound.
Interesting.
And again, key point is you only need 2 out of 3.
Okay.
And I could talk about PCOS all day because I think it's so cool, but I'll just briefly drop here and we can talk more about it in the comments if you guys are interested, but there's all sorts of emerging evidence and research into the different phenotypes of PCOS or like why some people can meet this criteria and have some features but not others.
Right.
So that, again, I think as we continue exploring this, there's likely a few subtypes of PCOS. And why some people develop one subtype and not another is a really interesting area of research, not to mention like what that means for people's overall health.
Yeah. So just to be clear, you technically can be diagnosed with PCOS without even having had an ultrasound then.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. You can. Although typically we recommend sending the ultrasound just for completion of the study,
sense.
Of the investigation.
So blood work.
Ultrasound.
Ultrasound and then just looking at your signs and symptoms.
And clinical symptoms.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay. Yeah. I think the other thing too is that people can have polycystic ovaries, right? And not have polycystic ovarian syndrome, right?
Okay.
Polycystic ovaries are actually a really common finding on ultrasound, especially in young women.
Okay.
But in the absence of elevated testosterone or elevated androgens, right? Or irregular periods, that person would not necessarily meet the criteria for PCOS. So if you have had an ultrasound investigating something else at some point and you saw a notation of polycystic ovaries, but you're having a period every month and you have no signs of high androgens, then you probably don't meet the criteria for PCOS.
Don't panic and think, oh, I have PCOS and I was never told.
I have seen many referrals coming from our colleagues, you know, out in the community, saying that somebody has PCOS and then I chat with them and actually they don't meet the other diagnostic criteria.
Okay. Right? Okay. That makes sense. Now, let's kind of talk about how common PCOS is because I think probably everyone listening either knows someone with PCOS or has a PCOS diagnosis themselves. Like, I feel like it's become more talked about online nowadays. I hear all the time, like I'm scrolling and then it's like, I have PCOS and these are my signs and symptoms. Like I see a lot of people talking about it online. So how does this mean that it is a super common diagnosis?
It's a super common diagnosis, right?
Yeah.
And again, as with so many things that affect women, it is probably underdiagnosed, right? But when we begin to try and estimate the prevalence, we are seeing rates of around 10 to 13% worldwide. Depending on the region, this can be higher or lower as well.
Okay.
It is also one of the leading causes of infertility or subfertility, right? So challenges getting pregnant. And again, this leads back to the lack of ovulation, right? In order to get pregnant, we have to release an egg so that egg and sperm can meet, the genetic material can combine, and an embryo and ultimately a fetus can start to develop, right? If you're not ovulating, it doesn't necessarily mean that there's something inherently wrong with your ovaries or your eggs themselves, right?
Yeah.
But you have to release the egg in order to be able to have egg and sperm meet, right?
Yeah.
And so if you're not ovulating, that can obviously present a challenge to spontaneous conception, right? Or just conceiving a pregnancy just from like sex at home with your partner.
Yeah. You're bringing up infertility as well. And I have seen a lot of stuff online where someone says, I was diagnosed with PCOS. I was told it would be very difficult to get pregnant or I was infertile.
Oh my God, I hate it so much.
I hear that a lot. And then they're like, so we went off of birth control because I didn't think
I could
get pregnant. And then they got pregnant right away, which isn't the case for everyone, but I've seen that a lot online.
So classically with PCOS too, right? Like people often don't just have no period. Some people can, right? Have anovulation and amenorrhea, right? No periods. But very frequently people have oligomenorrhea.
Yeah.
Which means less frequent periods.
Yeah.
Which really means that it's harder to time intercourse, right? Yeah. Because you don't necessarily know when you're going to be ovulating. You ovulate a little bit more unpredictably than other people.
Yeah.
But that certainly means that for many of these people, they still ovulate.
Yeah.
Just not in the kind of coordinated schedule that we would expect. And so It makes it
harder
if you're actively trying to conceive, to plan for sex around the time of ovulation or at least like presence of sperm around the time of ovulation, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. But it certainly does not mean that you cannot get pregnant.
Okay.
And I have seen many people like that as well who've been told that they're infertile. I find I'm like walking that diagnosis back a lot in my clinic when I see patients with PCOS, because you're right. I think that was kind of the like old school way to think of PCOS.
Yeah.
Was that people couldn't get pregnant, right? But we just know that that is not true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. Good to know. Yeah. So if you do have a PCOS diagnosis and you were told you're infertile.
PCOS is not a method of contraception.
No, no.
If you do not want to be pregnant, you should still be using something for contraception.
Yes. And then if you do want to get pregnant and you're having trouble timing that, there are things that that we can do to help with your ovulation, regulating it, and hopefully conceiving as well. So it's not, doesn't mean you'll never be able to get pregnant
all.
It just means you might need a little bit of extra assistance with timing and all of that kind of stuff. But, I've definitely seen a lot of patients who have a diagnosis of PCOS who have had multiple pregnancies. So
I'm sure you've seen patients like roll up in triage to Sydney and you're starting to take the history and you hear PCOS and then they'll say something like, oh, you know, it's funny. My doctor, when I was a teenager and was diagnosed with this, told me I could never get pregnant. And here I am.
I am on baby number three.
So again, I don't want that to take away from the experience of people who have struggled with their fertility due to PCOS.
Yes.
Right?
Because that is a real thing too.
100%.
And still very hard.
But it is certainly not a reason in and of itself to carry the burden of a diagnosis of infertility or subfertility before you've even started trying to get pregnant.
Yeah.
And definitely, definitely, again, especially to our younger listeners who perhaps do not want to get pregnant right away.
Yeah.
Do not count on your PCOS to prevent pregnancy, especially if you're having somewhat regular unprotected intercourse.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, that kind of highlights the difficulties that people with PCOS experience with with infertility, but also just the symptoms that they experience, like, can be very difficult too.
Yeah.
So, you know, it could be frustrating when you don't know when your period's going to come. Yeah, I can imagine that would be that would cause me a lot of stress if I couldn't keep track of that at all, and you know the emotional toll of the symptoms as well. The hair thinning.
Yeah.
What are some of the other ones you were saying? The irregular hair pattern growths as well.
Yeah. So like people on the face. Get growth on the face, like hair growth on their face, on their chest.
Yeah.
And kind of more of a male pattern typically.
Okay.
Sometimes because of insulin resistance, people can find that again, that they are putting on weight when they're not trying to put on weight, right? Mm-hmm. Or that they're finding it really, really difficult or impossible to take it off.
Yeah, yeah.
Sometimes people can develop what's called acanthosis nigricans, which is like a darkening of the skin, particularly in like flexural areas.
Right.
So like creases of our body, like elbow, like the inside of your elbow, around your neck, things like that. That's also associated with insulin resistance.
Gotcha, yeah.
And irregular periods.
Okay. Right? And what are some things that you as the doctor can do to help with these symptoms and help with the underlying diagnosis of PCOS? How do we manage this diagnosis?
Oh my gosh, in so many cool different ways. But if I can redirect us for one moment, Sydney takes me down the management, and I know you guys want to hear about the management, and I want to talk about the management. But if you'll entertain me for one second, let me talk about a little bit about the genetics of PCOS.
Oh,
because
okay, cool.
I think that this is really interesting. And again, it's a really like emerging area, I think. Absolutely. So we've known that there's a genetic link with PCOS for quite some time. And part of that comes back to twin studies where we have looked at like, do siblings, do twins, do families develop diseases at a higher rate than other families? And that, I think, you know, bench scientists, correct me if you feel that this is like way off base, but I find that that's oftentimes where these like hypotheses begin, right? Yeah. Is in finding an association in family studies and then having to say, okay, what genes could be implicated in this? Why is this happening in families more so than in non-related populations? So we've known for a while that the prevalence of PCOS is higher in mothers and sisters and daughters of PCOS women than in unrelated women.
Okay.
So in families where PCOS is present, the prevalence is more like 20 to 40% as opposed to that kind of 10% baseline, which is a significant difference, right?
Yeah.
And how we're kind of coming to understand it, There are certainly some genes that we're seeing associated with PCOS, but we're also finding that there is an epigenetic component to PCOS as well, which in brief kind of talks about the way that our environment, which includes things like lifestyle and diet and exposures, affect whether or not a gene that we possess is expressed. So whether or not we experience symptoms, side effects, disease development or not. So epigenetics, again, in brief, kind of means whether our genes are turned off or turned on without actually changing the code. And so it's like if you imagine like the wiring in your house for lights. You can turn on or off those lights, but that doesn't actually change how the house is wired, right? Epigenetics are the same, right? The brightness can change depending on outside factors, but the wiring may remain the same. So again, we think that there is some wiring associated with PCOS. There are some genes that are associated with PCOS. Okay. But whether or not they get turned on depends on other factors that, again, we're beginning to kind of suss out. Okay. And this is kind of why we think that this condition can develop and run in families and also can present really differently in different families and in different people.
Yeah.
The DNA itself doesn't explain it all, right?
Interesting.
And so there's a few different things that we think are impacted here. One is the DNA methylation, which kind of acts like a dimmer switch for genes. And this is potentially what is impacting like the unbalance, I suppose, if you will, of the hormones and their impact on metabolism as a whole. We also think that there may be an issue with histones, which are kind of the packaging of DNA. It's like proteins that the DNA wraps around. And if they're packed too loosely or too tightly, the wrong genes may get switched on or off. And then the last thing is something called microRNA, which are small molecules that basically block certain genes from making proteins. And in PCOS, we think that microRNAs can potentially make hormones and metabolism problems worse. So these changes may begin before birth, but they also can be influenced by things like environment and lifestyle. So again, that's why PCOS certainly seems to run in families, but also can look different person to person within a family and certainly can look different family to family.
Interesting.
So, I think it's cool.
No, it is cool.
I think it's interesting.
And so what you're saying is potentially also like some people might be overweight and some people might not be.
100% And we are seeing that in PCOS phenotypes. So we are certainly seeing some phenotypes where people have, for instance, irregular ovulation and weight gain, but maybe perhaps not other features. Or we see that very frequently with like a normal BMI PCOS picture, right? Like we certainly see people who don't meet that phenotypic, but phenotype, by the way, is like the way that genes express visually. Right? That we can see. So as like as oversimplification, but that's why we can see some people that again, our normal BMI, when we perhaps would expect a higher proportion of people to have higher BMI or to be in larger bodies, but have all the same dysfunction, right? From the hormonal perspective.
Interesting. And then when you're saying environmental factors, so is, you know, diet changes and lifestyle changes, is that part of your management plan when dealing with people with PCOS? Like, does that help everyone or is it very individualized?
So absolutely. Lifestyle factors are mainstay of like first line PCOS management. And I think what we choose with respect to management kind of depends on like what we're targeting and why, right? Because as we've discussed, PCOS has implications that run downstream. It's not just the hormones themselves. And again, just as a brief summary before we get into it, some of the things that people experience are, again, absent or irregular periods, right? And that's caused by a lack of ovulation or irregular ovulation. Cycles can be long, unpredictable, skipped altogether, right? We also can have androgen-related symptoms, right? Caused by that excess of testosterone and other androgens within the body. That can present like acne, especially persisting beyond teenage years. Something we call hirsutism, which is extra coarse hair growth, particularly in places like the chin, on the chest, the upper lip, shoulders, stomach, back. Scalp hair thinning or even male pattern hair loss can be one as well. infertility, as we've discussed. And again, the main issue with infertility is anovulation. It's not releasing an egg.
Yeah. The timing of it, you can't quite get right.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then there are some long-term risks associated with PCOS as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So we know that when we are not ovulating, we are often not receiving the signal then as well to shed our endometrial lining, right? Okay. So ovulation, when we ovulate, again, go back and listen to the This Is Your Body on the Pill episode.
It'll make more sense.
I'm really proud of that explanation.
It's very complex. I have to say, even learning about the menstrual cycle in school, I remember almost being in tears trying to understand it truly because it was just so complex, but I do find the way you explained it was one of the first times I feel like it really made sense.
Sydney, I'm so glad.
No, it's true. It's true because it is it's a tough one, I have to say.
Even Dan understood it.
He was into that episode.
You guys can't see off camera, but Sydney's husband.
Yeah, now my now husband.
Sydney's husband, Dan, is always just off camera managing our sound. Yes. And he afterwards too is like, wow, that's so cool.
That was cool. Yeah, exactly.
And so, I'm joking, guys. I'll explain it as many times as you want. But briefly, when we release that egg, right, from the dominant follicle, kind of the shell of the egg, if you will, remains kind of hormonally active. Mm-hmm. And it's called the corpus luteum. And it starts producing a hormone called progesterone, which helps to stabilize the endometrial lining or the inner lining of the uterus, which has grown nice and thick and plush in order to be a soft place to land for a fertilized egg to develop.
Yeah.
So the corpus luteum produces that progesterone, stabilizing that lining. But if no implantation occurs, it kind of can't sustain things all on its own, right? And so it involutes, the progesterone level drops, and it's that drop that signals to your uterus to start contracting to shed the lining.
Which gives you a period.
Exactly. So if we don't get that corpus luteum cyst, we don't get that progesterone drop, which means we don't receive the signal to shed our lining. Mm. And an endometrial lining that builds up over time with what we would call unopposed estrogen, right? We are still producing some estrogen during PCOS, but it's not countered by that progesterone and then the progesterone withdrawal to cause the lining to shed. Mm-hmm. And we know that processes that are left unchecked over time are particularly vulnerable to mutations, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And cancer very frequently is caused by mutations, right?
Yeah.
So PCOS in the long run does carry with it an elevated risk of endometrial cancer, so cancer of that inner lining of the uterus, but specifically, again, when it's not managed.
Okay.
Right? So this is if people are not having periods for many, many years over a long period of time, right? And and not having periods like for longer than 3 months at a time.
Right. Right? Now, so where my brain goes is I have an IUD right now and my body doesn't, you know, I don't usually have a period or I'll have a small period. However, I know that IUDs prevent that endometrial lining from becoming thick and needing to necessarily shed.
Yes.
So my not doctor brain is thinking, well, would an IUD be helpful for these patients?
Absolutely.
Then?
Okay. An IUD is definitely helpful for protection of the endometrium, right? In the context of PCOS. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't tackle everything we might want to tackle.
Okay.
I'm going to get into that in a second. I realize I'm like ruining Sydney's flow so much in this episode.
I'm literally, no, you're not. I'm just thinking about these things. I'm like, ooh, I feel like an IUD would fix this.
You're right. An IUD does. An IUD totally addresses that. An IUD totally addresses that. Guys, I like, these gyne episodes, Sydney's just going to like kill me through them because I'm such a huge geek about it.
No.
I love talking about it. And so I feel like I'm just like a woman on a mission every time we have a gyne episode.
No, I'm not even following our little layout right now. I'm just like, I genuinely thought an IUD would be cool. Like it would fix it.
It is. It totally is.
Okay.
Put a pin in that, friends. Okay. We're coming back to it. So the other long-term risks associated with PCOS are metabolic risks, right? And what I mean by that is the risk of greater endocrine issues due to things like the elevated or rather the insulin resistance, right?
Yeah.
So many people with PCOS, as we've discussed, have higher levels of insulin and increased insulin resistance, which eventually can progress to diabetes. Mm-hmm. And so people with PCOS do have a 3- to 4-fold higher risk of type 2 diabetes over their lifetime. Mm-hmm. That's independent of age and BMI.
Yeah.
But I think it's important to note as well that that risk is actually strongly modified by adiposity in favor of increasing the risk. Mm. Adiposity, what I mean by that is having just greater fat stores on the body,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So for people who are in larger bodies who have greater fat stores,
yeah.
the risk, depending on size, can be up to 8 times higher.
Wow.
Right? The other thing is cardiovascular risk as well. Yep. Yep. PCOS is linked with higher rates of high blood pressure, abnormal cholesterol, and heart disease later in life. Now, the effect of PCOS on those things is less pronounced. It's about 1.25 to 2.5 times higher.
Yeah.
But I think what's important to note as well, like I think most of our audience is fairly young, right? And mm-hmm. the absolute risk, right? So the baseline risk of those things happening is very low. In young okay. women, right? Okay. So even a like 1.25 increase is okay. still going to give you a number that is a very low risk of okay. having heart
so
disease.
So don't freak out.
Especially if you're in your like 20 or 30s, right?
Yeah.
But as age increases, right?
Then your risk increases.
Especially
slightly.
With things like weight gain and other comorbidities like development of diabetes, mm-hmm. that rate does go up.
Okay.
Okay, so now, Sydney, we're going to get into what we can do about it.
I'm like, I just want you to tell people how to fix it.
Like, Sydney, I have a plan. I'm getting there.
I'm sorry. Give me a second. I'm jumping ahead. Okay, but what is your first line treatment? What do you do?
So first and foremost, lifestyle modification is really, really helpful, right?
Helpful and healthy.
So healthy eating, weight management, and physical activity are all things that have really good positive impacts on PCOS, as well as mitigating the risk of those long-term consequences, right?
Okay, yeah.
So these changes improve our metabolism and our reproductive hormones, as well as inflammation within our bodies. And there is some, like, I like hesitate to frame this for a second, because I think there's a lot of companies and groups out there who are really trying to like profit from women off of women and this diagnosis in general. Mm-hmm. There is some beginning evidence that perhaps diet and lifestyle modifications can start to reverse some of the epigenetic effects of PCOS,
okay.
right?
Interesting.
So, because a lot of the things we're going to talk about with treatment are really like managing the downstream things, right? Mm-hmm. Not necessarily that like that LHFSH dysfunction to begin with. But there is some evidence that in diet, in lifestyle, we can perhaps begin to turn off those gene signals.
Interesting.
Now, there is no good study that shows that like one diet or one lifestyle modification is mm-hmm. going to like do that entirely for every single person, mm-hmm. right? Because like anything, this is multifactorial, which means that there's a bunch of genes associated with PCOS. There's a bunch of different epigenetic effects, right? Like the histones, the methylation, the microRNA, all of those things are not necessarily going to respond to the same treatments, right?
Yeah.
But this is very much a watch this space. And I think further kind of onus for diet lifestyle modifications to be a focus in anyone's PCOS mm-hmm. management, right?
Okay.
Now, medical options as well. Mm-hmm. So one of the mainstays of medical option is a combined oral contraceptive or a birth control pill, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Now, for many people, we might not be necessarily using this for contraception, right? I have patients certainly who've like had a salpingectomy, right?
Yeah.
Had their tubes out, who have no plans to get pregnant, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or who don't even need contraception, right?
Yeah.
But the reason that an oral birth control pill is helpful in this case, a combined oral contraceptive specifically, is because a combined oral contraceptive contains both estrogen and progesterone, mm-hmm. right? The estrogen component to the birth control pill increases something called sex hormone binding globulin. Mm. And it kind of is like pretty aptly named. I like to think of sex hormone binding globulin as a bus that just like drives around our bodies and it just mops up excess hormone that's mm-hmm. hanging out. And so what that does is it binds up free testosterone to make it less active. Progestins also keep the endometrial lining nice and thin, mm-hmm. which is going to decrease that risk of endometrial cancer in the long run.
Okay.
So I think the thing that is nice about the combined oral contraceptive is that it kind of does twofold action, right? Mm. Progestins alone do decrease some of the production of androgens based on decreasing that LH production or that LH release.
Release, yeah.
But it's not quite as strong as like driving that bus around to collect all of the free testosterone and androgens that are already circulating in your bloodstream, which we can do by giving estrogen, which in turn, as we discussed, increases sex hormone binding globulin.
Yeah.
By the way, this is like the bus analogy is something I've thought about for a really long time. Like literally, I remember studying for my board exams, Royal College exams in Canada for the Americans. I sometimes refer to them as board exams in an international kind of setting.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But it's called the Royal College here in Canada. But yeah, that's how I remembered the details around sex hormone binding globulin. I just like thought of a little bus driving around and picking up different sex hormones
that's
as it went.
Cute,
it's totally cute.
Sometimes you gotta be creative with
you gotta all of the whatever
to
works,
memorize.
Right?
Yep.
Whatever works.
Yeah.
As you mentioned, these processes can be really complicated.
Yeah.
And I'm sure not to like toot my own horn a little bit, but. Yeah. It was so esoteric. It was so detailed on the Royal College exam.
Yep. Yeah.
The level of detail I needed to know just like made my brain hurt.
Yeah.
And
you gotta
do what you gotta do.
But listen, it's coming in handy now.
I hope the bus works for you guys too, because that's what I think about when I think about sex hormone binding globulin.
Yeah.
Anyway. Progestin only methods also great, right? And again, like I will prescribe those to patients, especially for those for whom an estrogen may be contraindicated, or maybe they're particularly sensitive to estrogens,
like a history of
like blood clot, for instance, right?
Yes,
like
or migraines,
migraine headache with aura, right? Would
yeah.
be contraindications to estrogen containing combined oral contraceptives.
Right. Yeah. Again, we talk about all of that in our episode on Your Body on the Pill.
We're really heavy-handed, I think, with this promotional push for
but it was such a good episode. I just feel like it goes so hand in hand. It's such a good intro to this episode.
It is a really good intro to this episode.
But anyways, keep going.
You're right. Now, so that's what we can do for decreasing that LH release and also kind of mopping up the androgens that are already there that are causing like the acne and the hair growth and the like male pattern like hair loss.
Okay.
But what can we do for the insulin component, right? Mm. What can we do to decrease our risk of diabetes in the long run, to help manage weight loss, that kind of thing?
Yeah.
Well, there's good evidence actually for metformin, which is a very common medication used in diabetes in general, right? In type 2 diabetes. So metformin basically makes the body's cells more sensitive to insulin. That way they can take up the sugar more effectively.
Mm-hmm.
And this then lowers circulating insulin levels, which in turn reduces the ovary's drive to make excess androgens, right? And sometimes that helps improve cycles and even provide a more regular ovulation pattern with PCOS. So metformin has actually really good evidence for it. Now, increasingly as well, we are seeing some evidence with GLP-1 receptor agonists, so more commonly known as things like Ozempic or Wegovy. They also improve insulin resistance in PCOS and some other metabolic issues associated with the syndrome as well. There's some early lab research as well to suggest that both of these medications may also help to reset some of those epigenetic changes. Although again, this hasn't been shown clearly in human trials. We are not like counseling patients that they can turn back the clock on their PCO with metformin and Ozempic. But it is but there certainly is good evidence that is well supported in all guidelines for the metabolic benefits of both of those medications. I think just with respect to the epigenetics, it's an evolving area, but something that's really cool to think about and a really promising area of study, I think, for PCOS in general.
Yeah, that maybe we can do also a future episode on.
Totally.
Once evidence gets a little bit more.
We'll update you as we go, guys.
Yeah.
So listen. Let's say we're on a birth control pill, right? We maybe have even added some metformin. So we're improving our metabolic health. We're able to lose some weight, perhaps. Our endometrium is protected. We've mopped up the excess androgen. But what if we're still experiencing those symptoms of acne, of hair loss, of abnormal patterns of hair growth? Well, that's when an anti-androgen medication can come into play. And something like a spironolactone is a really nice choice for that. So basically what that does is it binds androgen receptors in the skin. So testosterone and other androgen derivatives can't bind and trigger things like acne or excess facial hair, right? It also reduces androgen production in the ovaries to a smaller extent.
Okay.
So basically, if we're driving the bus around and we can't grab enough of it, right, and decreasing the production isn't really enough, then what we can also do to help people's symptoms is to block those receptors in the skin and tissues that would be otherwise responsive to the testosterone that would be causing the acne. So again, it's a little bit more of a downstream effect, but it certainly is something that can be a really nice adjunct therapy, especially when people are experiencing the acne, the hirsutism in a higher amount.
Okay. Now, what about patients who are wanting to get pregnant but are having trouble timing that ovulation because they don't know when they're going to ovulate? Is there something that can help with inducing ovulation, I guess?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I'll say just before we get into that part as well, that if you are looking to get pregnant, something like a spironolactone is actually not a good option.
Okay. It's contraindicated
Okay. So number one, it doesn't fix the underlying issues with PCOS. So it's never kind of like our best management when used in all on its own.
Yeah.
It's usually paired with something to manage those other side effects of PCOS. Yep. But it also can cause problems, especially if a male fetus is being developed, right? Because it blocks androgen. And so we don't recommend spironolactone in the context of trying to conceive.
Yep.
And certainly we actually typically recommend also using contraception, right?
Yeah.
Again, number one, because the combined oral contraceptive has all the benefits we've listed already for PCO, but also because it prevents pregnancy in that context.
Yeah.
Now, fertility treatments are available for PCOS. And I won't get into too many of the details. Number one, because I'm not a reproductive endocrinologist and infertility specialist. I'm not an REI. That was not the fellowship that I did.
Yeah.
Fertility can be multifactorial, right? And can get very complicated very quickly. To hear some of my colleagues talk about and like get into the weeds of fertility treatments, it's so cool.
Yeah.
The medicine is so cool in that area. I will just be the first to say that with respect to understanding of fertility, I'm a generalist in that area, I won't claim to know even a fraction of what my REI colleagues do.
We need to have a fertility specialist on here, though.
Oh, for
100%.
Sure,
100%. We will in the future.
For sure. But in brief, with respect to fertility related to anovulation, I do kind of want to talk about that because I think again, people really worry about their fertility when they've been diagnosed with PCOS. And there are medications we can use to make you ovulate, right? If anovulation or lack of ovulation is the main problem with PCO, there actually are medications that we can use to prompt ovulation, right? And one of those would be letrozole.
Yeah.
So letrozole is an aromatase inhibitor. And basically what it does is it lowers estrogen briefly, which tricks the brain into releasing more FSH.
Yeah.
The FSH then stimulates the ovary to mature and to release an egg.
Yeah.
And it is shown in multiple trials to be quite effective. Now, we used to use a medication called Clomid. It's also not available anymore in Canada, or at least at the time I wrote my Royal College exam, it was not available in Canada. But in some studies, the letrozole has been shown to be more effective in any case. And further into the weeds, I will not go because I'm sure my REI colleagues would be very quick to say, well, in this case or in that case, and they'd be totally, totally right. But I think, again, like it's important to know that there are options for fertility associated with PCOS, particularly if the only problem we're dealing with is ovulation, right? That's a thing that has some really good evidence for it and good solutions available. Practically speaking, I would refer a lot of my patients who are trying to conceive with PCOS to a fertility clinic. I realize that's not always an option everywhere, either because of lack of access to fertility clinics or perhaps because of financial costs in areas where the visits themselves, you know, we're very lucky in Canada, the visits to fertility themselves are covered under our healthcare, our universal healthcare, although IVF, for instance, and some of the treatments are not necessarily always covered in every province. But in other places, of course, fertility clinics are much more private, standalone, and there's costs associated with that.
Yeah.
I know that there are some general OBGYNs who do dabble in some of this initial fertility management, especially for conditions like PCOS. And so seeking out a provider that feels comfortable navigating that with you, whether it be through a referral to fertility clinics or through, you know, seeking a provider or a referral to a provider that is able to start some of that management, I think can be really, really helpful. Now, as we stand with PCOS, there isn't necessarily like a cure, yeah, right?
Yeah.
Because this is, again, it's multifactorial, it's genetic, it's epigenetic.
Yeah.
But I think what should be heartening, I hope, for people listening is that there are lots of management options that can be really effective.
Yep.
Finding the right one for you can be a challenge because there's so many different variations of it, as we've talked about, right? But there are solutions available. There are ways that we can improve the symptoms that you're experiencing at the very least.
Yep. That makes sense.
Now, Sydney, I know that you've done some reading and some looking online about kind of what the sentiments are out there. What are people saying about PCOS?
Yeah, which I, you know, this is kind of where I want you to come in and fact check all of these things because, you know, I think with anything you see online, you know, take it with a grain of salt.
Yeah.
It's probably not true, but that's why we, again, created the Push Podcast to hopefully decrease some of that misinformation online. But so much on diet changes and how, you know, well, if I cut out gluten from my diet and, you know, my acne got so much better, my symptoms completely disappeared or I cut out sugar completely. That was a huge one. Sugar and gluten were like everywhere. What is the evidence? Like, I know you said earlier in the episode, diet does play a role. So, but does that necessarily mean that you need to go gluten-free and sugar-free? Or is it just mean from a generalized perspective of just making sure you're having a well-balanced, well-rounded diet?
I mean, definitely well-rounded, well-balanced diet is a great mainstay.
Yeah.
And I think irrespective of specific dietary approach, we do have lots of evidence that especially for people in larger bodies, even modest weight loss, so even like 5% of your body weight can improve insulin resistance and your hormone balance and ovulation in general. Now, there have been some studies that have looked at different diets like the Mediterranean diet, a low glycemic index diet, even the keto diet. And there are lots of studies that have shown benefit with different dietary interventions. However, I think what makes it challenging as we sit back here as providers to like give carte blanche advice to anybody is that when we've looked at these diets in comparison to one another, right now it doesn't look like there's one that's superior, right? So certainly having a well-rounded, healthy diet is helpful. Some specific diets have shown good effect with PCO for like things like return of ovulation and insulin resistance. But right now we don't have enough evidence to say that like one is obviously better than the other for everybody. And it's possible that we may not have good evidence at least for a while on that, right? In part because as we've like discussed ad nauseum in this episode, PCOS is really, really different amongst different people, even within the same family, right? So it kind of makes sense intuitively that what works for one person might not work for another person. But my advice with all, you know, lifestyle modifications, diets, things like that for my patients, and I get this question a lot with other disorders too, right? Is if there's something that you want to try, if you feel like it's not going to, number one, break the bank, right? If it's not going to cause harm to you, and if you feel like it's reasonable in the context of your life, right? I don't want someone to be miserable because they're cutting out everything that is enjoyable to them or doing a diet that like really doesn't fall in line with their culture or their eating habits or their lifestyle. As long as it doesn't, you know, it meets that, those criteria, I say go for it, right? Regardless of whether I have specific evidence for, you know, benefit or benefit specifically, right?
Yeah. And also, you know, taking caution in supplements and advertisements for that kind of stuff online, just because I think that with a, like with a lot of things, it's targeting your need to treat the symptoms of PCOS, and it might not necessarily be doing anything other than making you spend money.
This is the thing.
So run those things by your doctor.
Totally. Yeah. Everyone wants to make the silver bullet, right? For any disease. Any company wants to do it. And I think I remind my patients a lot, I have no problems with, you know, the natural health industry as like a general concept. But I do remind my patients a lot that, especially as we quite rightly like scrutinize the pharmaceutical industry for lots of their practices, the natural health industry is also a for-profit industry, right? That is actually under considerable considerably less scrutiny than the pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Just because it's natural doesn't mean that they're not looking to make money off of you in the same way or sometimes more aggressively than the pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah.
So again, doesn't mean that those things can't be helpful, but I think it is a good grain of salt to take anytime we're considering things like supplements, right?
Yeah.
Now, there is one supplement that we're beginning to see some interesting evidence for, and that one is called inositol. So basically, it's a naturally occurring sugar involved in insulin signaling and in ovarian hormone production. Supplements are widely available and they're generally considered to be safe. Research has shown that there is perhaps a modest improvement with use of inositol in menstrual regularity and ovulation, insulin sensitivity, as well as some androgen-related symptoms. It can work like metformin, but sometimes people say that it has fewer stomach side effects than metformin.
Okay.
So basically, the our guidelines in our societies are saying the inositol can be considered, right, since it's safe and low risk, but it doesn't necessarily perform better in the preliminary studies that we have. Metformin is certainly still preferred because it has broader reaching improvements than something like inositol for overall metabolic management. And again, no specific type or dose or ratio has really been elucidated to be the best. So I think my overall note with that one in particular is that for some people, and I see that actually online. For whatever reason, that's been like very targeted to me as I've been scrolling while I was researching this episode. And inositol, it sounds like, can definitely potentially be helpful. It probably isn't the silver bullet. Other medications do seem to perform better in studies, but as an adjunct, right? If it's, again, not going to cause harm, not going to break the bank, and you're doing other things to, for instance, protect your endometrium, right? Which may not be addressed by the inositol. Then I see under the guidance of a physician of your, who's comfortable with PCOS, it seems like on the outset, there's no, you know, harm to it.
I also got, when I was scrolling, spearmint tea specifically was also recommended a lot, which I was like, I drink spearmint tea every single night before bed.
It's so interesting.
But yeah, there's all kinds of stuff online. It's like you don't know what to what's real and what's not, right? So I think our advice too is to always just bring these things back to your provider who knows your particular situation, who can, you know, give you the evidence on these things because they're experts in this area. But one thing I did want to say was that as you've probably seen online, like, you did not cause your PCOS. That is something that I think so many people probably feel so much guilt about because it's constantly online. It's saying, like, you need to modify your diet. You need to exercise more. It's because you ate so-and-so and you don't, you're not an active person that you have PCOS, and that is not true. Okay. So keep that in mind. Don't blame yourself. Don't feel guilty. Because that's not the truth. There's these things can help to mitigate symptoms. But it doesn't necessarily mean that that's what caused your PCOS in the first place. That's not the case.
I think as we talk about like a multifactorial like root, right? Sometimes what that makes us think, particularly if we hear that there are environmental factors that can impact things, is that, oh, well, there's something I can control and I can walk it back or I can change that thing. And while that very well may be true, I also, I totally agree with you, Sid, that this other side to that coin is blame associated with whatever the thing was that like turned on the gene, right? And I think when we're really truly considering multifactorial causes, like environment absolutely plays a role, but so does just the genetic like conditions. The genetic component, right? It's far too complicated, a disease and a syndrome To simplify into like,
you ate dairy, so that's why you have
you ate dairy. Lay off the gummy bears. Like, I don't know. I use gummy bears because we're like, we're big. My husband and I are gonna.
You love gummy bears?
We love jujubes specifically, actually. You know, this is a total aside, but that was the thing that we bonded on at the beginning was our very unpopular favorite candy.
Gummy bears. Interesting.
No, jujubes.
Oh, jujubes and jujubes. Like the typical jujubes.
Yeah, like classic
jujubes. My mom loves jujubes too.
Well, my mom loves jujubes.
Maybe that makes sense. I like black jujubes.
Maybe
I'm
it's
a weirdo
genetic.
In that way.
You're a weirdo.
Yeah. I know. I know.
So I know. To wrap it up, guys, I am disowning Sydney as a family member for love of black jujubes.
I will eat them. Okay. So it's a good,
you know,
we're
maybe
good
we're perfect. We're a perfect pair that way.
Anyways, so let's talk about just, I guess, wrapping things up and takeaways from this episode that, that you want people to know.
Yeah. You know what? I think, again, as we've discussed, PCOS has a bunch of different causes. It has a bunch of different treatments. But I think if we take really like a intentional approach to what is the, what are the symptoms that you're experiencing? What are the causes or the like upstream things that are impacting the development of that symptom? Mm-hmm. And then what do we have at our disposal to begin to target that symptom combined with the umbrella of lifestyle and dietary modifications?
Yeah.
I think that we can approach PCOS in a really nuanced way. And the challenge is that that takes time and it takes intention from both provider and from patient.
Yeah.
And so I encourage all of our providers who may be listening to take the time for that insofar as we can, right? And for patients to continue doing your homework, become more informed about PCOS and the things that might be available to you and what you would find helpful, right? Yeah. Like we may be the experts in the science and in the pathophysiology of it, but you're the expert in what you're experiencing in your body. Yeah. And that is such an important, like this is such a good example of why good communication is essential, because I can't really effectively treat your PCOS if I don't know what the symptoms are that you're experiencing and what's most bothersome to you, right? That's really going to drive how we target this and what we do about it. Yeah,
and if you're listening to this episode and you're, you know, you're relating to a lot of the symptoms and the signs that we talked about, and you suspect that maybe this is something that you have, bring those questions and those concerns up to your care provider, because they're the ones who ultimately are going to be able to diagnose you with this, and then help you find ways to manage the symptoms that you're experiencing.
Yeah. And now we've spoken a lot, I mean, we've spoken for like an hour about PCOS. But I think it's also important, especially in the era of social media where we're all kind of self-diagnosing on the internet and we're as guilty of it as anybody else.
Absolutely.
That there are lots of PCOS mimickers out there, right? So there are other endocrine disorders, other hormonal disorders that can mimic the symptoms of PCOS. Yeah. And so equally as important as being aware of your symptoms and considering PCOS is also to make sure that other etiologies, other conditions are also considered when we're working this
out. Which is important. That's why that's why it's important to bring it up to a healthcare provider who can who can go through that list and knows all the other diagnoses that that are out there. Because there are so many, right?
Oh, and, for sure.
And it's important to get checked out though, so that ultimately you can live your life. Live your life to the fullest.
So listen, let us know, you guys, your experiences with PCOS.
Yes, yes, especially for September, which is PCOS Awareness Month.
Exactly.
Which is why we wanted to have this conversation today. So
what has worked for you? What hasn't worked for you?
Yeah. We want to know. Make sure you comment and follow us on TikTok and Instagram at the .push.podcast. That's where, you know, we can have even more of these discussions. And we love to hear from you guys. We love it.
Yeah.
And just kind of continue to build this community, because you're not alone in these symptoms. A lot of people experience this. And we want to be a safe space for you to share your experience online.
Totally.
So
And your PCOS is not a form of contraception.
Very good point. Okay. Very good point. And on that note, check back next Wednesday. We will have a new episode of the Push Podcast.
Yep.
But until then, bye.
See you next time.